Okay, today I have a wonderful guest. We're going to examine a couple issues here dominating the national criminal justice discussion. First, whether intense media attention surrounding high-profile offenders inspires what's called copycat violence, the emerging Luigi Mangione effect. And second, what the data actually says about the defensive gun use in America. So first segment of this, we're going to get into that copycat violence. The second segment, we're going to talk about the defensive gun use in America. Joining us is one of the nation's foremost crime economists and firearms policy researchers, Dr. John R. Lott Jr. He is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, former DOJ senior advisor, prolific scholar, and author of More Guns, Less Crime, and Gun Control Myths. If you look above my right shoulder, if you've got your cameras where you're using it, for those that are streaming, you can see his book, More Guns, Less Crime, right there. He also wrote Gun Control Myths. We'll examine the criminological realities behind media contagion, offender glorification, deterrence, and whether ordinary citizens use firearms defensively far more often than criminals use them offensively. We're also going to explore how modern media ecosystems, social media algorithms, and cultural fascination with violent offenders may unintentionally and sometimes intentionally incentivize deviant behavior by transforming criminals into what's called the anti-hero effect or celebrity effect, from copycat violence and the erosion of moral accountability to the debate over armed self-defense and constitutional liberties. Today's discussion cuts through the political narratives and focuses on empirical evidence, public safety, and the deeper cultural forces shaping America today. Joining us is Dr. John R. Lott, Jr. Again, he's president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and one of the most cited economists in the world on crime and public policy. On a personal note, Dr. Lott has long been a very well-respected economist. As far as I'm concerned, he's somebody that I go to. And there's many economists that have done a wonderful job in discussing and researching crime statistics. I think they do more than most criminologists do, quite frankly. During the Trump administration, Dr. Lott served as senior advisor of research and statistics at the U.S. Department of Justice. He held positions at the University of Chicago, Yale, Stanford, UCLA, Rice University, and the Wharton School. He is the author of more than 100 peer-reviewed and academic articles, 10 books, including More Guns, Less Crime, as I cited earlier, The Bias Against Guns, and Gun Control Myths. One of my other favorite economists, Milton Friedman, once said, John Lott has few equals as a perceptive analyst of controversial public policy issues. Dr. Lott, my friend, thanks for coming. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on. I greatly appreciate it.
Very good. Well, in this segment, we're going to tackle about one of the most dangerous and under-discussed criminological phenomenons in American society. It's called the contagion effect. Social contagions are alive and well right now, Dr. Lott. It's also fostered, I think, more because of the use of social media. I think we have also untreated mental health and mental illness that is adding to that. We have places like California. They don't have mandated treatment for mental health anymore. They don't have mandated treatment for drug cases anymore. They don't have mandated jail. It really depends on the prosecutor and the judges. And California, for instance, is not taking too many people in because the governor there has decided he's not going to fund prisons. So those are some of the issues that we're seeing. If in many ways the broken window theory here applies, and if we just follow it, we were talking about this before the show started. If we just follow really the main principles of the broken window theory, it seems like we wouldn't be into the problems that we're having today. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think there are lots of things involved here. Obviously, broken windows, the notion is that if you have a lot of low-level crime that's occurring in an area, people may be afraid or uncomfortable being outside. And if you don't have people outside, you're going to have fewer witnesses that are going to be there in case crimes occur. Criminals are going to be able to go and commit crime with kind of more with less concern that they're going to be caught and punished. And it's not really rocket science that we're talking about here. If you want to reduce crime, you have to make it riskier for criminals to commit crime. That means things like higher arrest rates, higher conviction rates, longer prison sentences. It also means being able to let victims defend themselves. All those things make it riskier for criminals to commit crime. And it's no different than anything else. I'm an economist, as you say. Economists say, well, if the price of apples go up, people buy fewer apples.
Right.
Well, if the cost of committing crime from criminals goes up, if it's riskier for them to do that, you're going to see less crime that's occurring.
Well, and as you noted, I think also it affects the business side of it because based on the economy, if you look again, states like California and Washington State, Oregon, New York now, where you have businesses actually abandoning their stores. And, some people are citing business regulations, which is true, and taxes, of course, but the underlying issue is crime that
Oh,
they
yeah, sure. Look, there's the direct victims of crime, obviously, but you have indirect victims of crime. So if I have more crime in an area, I mean, I may have more theft and things like that, and they may cause stores to close. But just the risk of being in an area where there's higher crime, stores may close. And the issue, I often, a lot of this debate about penalties has to do with, well, they are concerned about the race of the criminal. My concern is the race of the victim. And one thing people don't understand is that people tend overwhelmingly to commit crimes against people who are like the criminals. About 90% of blacks are murdered by other blacks. But so you have crime occurring in the areas which are similar to the demographics of the criminals that are there. And so when you have businesses close, who works in those stores? Who shops in those stores? Who disproportionately owned the businesses in those areas? Who owned homes in areas whose property values are depressed because of things like higher violent crime rates that are occurring? So they're poorer as a result of that. And so, you have a very wide range of victims beyond, obviously you have the direct victims, the people who are murdered, the people who are raped or assaulted, or robbed, but you also have all these other people who are hurt as a result of the crimes.
We have seen copycat cases. I've worked them before in law enforcement when I was a special agent, when I worked homicides. It seems to me that today we're seeing even more copycat effects, and it's getting to the point where they call it this L Luigi Mangione effect. Can you explain why that particular case gained such notoriety, and perhaps why in particular this person became basically idolized by the left?
Well, I mean, this type of copycat is something, as you indicate, we've seen for a long time. You can go and look at things like mass public shootings, for example, going all the way back to Columbine, Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris, in their writings that they had there, made it very clear that they wanted to go and obtain fame. And you see time after time in the diaries and manifestos that these mass murderers leave behind, they talk about wanting to go and kill more, get more media attention than some other previous killer had gotten. And you look at something like the Sandy Hook killer. He had done what police described as essentially a doctoral dissertation, where he looked at mass shootings over the previous 40 years. And according to one police report, he had graphed out the relationship between the number of people killed in different attacks around the world and the amount of media attention that they got. He wanted to go and kill more people than the Norway killer had killed, who killed 67 people, if you just look at the gunshot deaths, not including the bombing deaths that he had there. And that's more than any mass public shooting in the United States. And he thought that if he could go and kill more people than that, then he could get even more worldwide media attention. My own belief, I have no proof for this, but my own guess is that one of the reasons why he attacked an elementary school was in part because of the shock value of killing little kids, and that he may have thought that that was going to help get him even more media attention. But you have individuals who are suicidal, who feel unappreciated, but they want people to know that they were here. And so, people have always wanted to commit suicide. But someplace along the line, people realize that they could get attention by going and killing lots of other people. And, it's important to understand that for a couple reasons. But one of the reasons why it's very important to understand that is that if you're going to stop these attacks, you have to understand what's motivating them, and you have to be able to go and take it away. Now, I don't think you need to go and have something like rewrite the First Amendment. I'm not even sure how you would do something like that, and I'm not supporting it. But once you realize that their goal is to get media attention, and they explicitly, time after time, in their diaries and manifestos, talk about how if they can only kill more people than such and such did, they can get even more media attention. The question becomes then, how can you limit the amount of harm that they can do so you can limit in their minds the amount of media attention they're going to get? And that has to do with issues like gun-free zones and stuff. And it's the reason why they explicitly, time after time, talk about why they pick the targets that they do. It's one of my biggest pet peeves with the media is that the media refuses to go and cover those parts of their diaries and manifestos where they explain why they pick the targets they do. You just will never see the media, even though the media covers the diaries and manifestos, they refuse to cover those parts of the diaries and manifestos where they explain why they pick the targets that they do. And I think that's a big mistake. But with
Well,
regards to
we have some places where law enforcement has refused to put out the manifestos too, where, and
No, it's
especially in.
very rare. I mean, you have like the Nashville school shooting case, the Catholic school shooting case there. The Biden administration quickly got a hold of the manifesto and they held that up. It was parts of it were leaked, and then finally, under the Trump administration last year, they released the whole manifesto that was there. But usually, almost right away, within less than a day, you'll get it. And we I force myself to read through these things, and we have links to them on our website at crimeresearch.org. And literally dozens of times you'll see explicit discussions in there about why they pick the targets that they do. But with regard to Luigi Mangione, the thing is, here you have all these women and other things, they're just kind of swooning over the guy. So it's not too surprising that you have other people who want to go and get that type of attention for themselves. And we put up a post on our website recently where we just went through quotes from people who have been committing these types of attacks afterwards. After his, where they kind of reference his as, kind of the motivation that they'd like to get similar type of attention.
Well, I mean, you see that with serial killers too, where or high profile murderers, sometimes they'll get all of a sudden tens of, dozens of women that
The
want
one
to
to
be their
marry him and
boyfriends and
stuff.
want to and half, and
No.
there's another thing that's I did research starting in about 2016, looking at mass shootings, and it was very interesting to see the trend increase in transgenderism related, or let me rephrase that, gender fluidity as being one of the issues, or maybe they didn't bring it up as an issue, but they were going through gender identity issues. And starting about 2020, it seemed like about 50% of the mass shootings that we saw had some link towards that kind of mental illness. Is that something else that is done through kind of a copycat, or as a researcher, how do you try to identify causal reasons why we're seeing that increase?
Well, I mean, there are two issues. One is there a pattern, and the other one is causality. Causality is harder
Yes.
to prove, but I think a lot of the media has written articles saying, well, trans individuals just don't make up that large of a percentage, like 10% or whatever, of these types of attacks, and that's small. Well, I think that's pretty misleading because you have to go and compare them to their share of the population. So if they make up less than 1% of the population, but they make up 10% of the attacks, that's pretty disproportionate there.
Right.
And on our website, we go through, simple statistical tests that are there. To go and show how disproportionate it is. I don't know of any other group in the population that's as disproportionately involved in either mass public shootings or in terms of active shooting attacks than either trans individuals or, I guess, Muslims. But those are basically the two groups that you see are disproportionately involved. And to me, it's not super shocking with regard to the trans individuals, and the reason is because, as I mentioned before, you're overwhelmingly talking about individuals who are suicidal, and we know that trans individuals are quite disproportionately suicidal, and so and they feel unappreciated or they feel put upon in some way, and so it's not shocking to me that they are so overrepresented there. But you got to look at it differently than I think the legacy media has been looking at it. And you have to go and say not just their share of the attackers, but also kind of compare it to their share of the population that's there.
Do you think social media now is one of the biggest accelerants for these kinds of violent contagions?
Well, it's hard to prove, but I think it probably has something to do with it. I think it has a lot to do with people being depressed. I think it has a lot to do with kind of people kind of getting into certain types of rabbit holes in terms of convincing themselves of different things. People kind of isolate themselves in terms of having individuals who are of the same view. You may only have a tiny percent of people in the country as a whole who do that, and particularly, you may have very few people in your local area who may have a certain view. But when you have social media that allows you to go and be contacts with people across the whole country or world, it's very likely that you can run into people who have similar views, and they feed on each other there. I'm most concerned. We recently put up a survey from YouGov, which looks at whether people think that violence is an appropriate way to deal with political differences that are there. And it's really pretty amazing. You see, people who classify themselves as very liberal think that that type of violence is acceptable at a rate that's about 9.5 times the rate that people who classify themselves as very conservative view such violence as acceptable. And a lot of it, I think, has to do, people have to be careful about the type of language that they're using. I mean, if people really believe that individuals are Hitler or fascist or whatever, I'm not sure what worse terms one can possibly use than those. But if you get even a tiny fraction of people who sincerely believe that those types of claims are accurate, it's not too surprising that you're going to see violence that occurs. And Luigi, obviously in his case, he thought he was justified in killing somebody who was a healthcare insurer that's there. And apparently there's a number of other people who feel he was justified in using that type of violence.
We also seem to be seeing an increase in the dark psychological traits In particular, I mean, we already have kind of advanced narcissism. Does that notoriety kind of motivate those kinds of persons that are suffering from those dark traits, especially if they're not getting the mental illness treatment that they should be getting?
Well, I think it goes and helps drives why they commit these crimes to get attention. They crave attention. Anybody who, and I force myself to read the diaries and manifestos for these mass murders because they're pretty depressing type of things. But you have time after time that people feel that they're not appreciated. Women won't go out on dates with them. You read the diaries and manifestos and you pretty much understand why they're not getting dates. But so they want their name to be in the history book. They want to be famous. They want to leave their mark on the world. Obviously that's somebody who is very obsessed with kind of how others view themselves and how they view themselves. It probably fits your discussion of narcissism that's there. They view themselves as being more important than others. Obviously, they're willing to sacrifice the lives of others in order to go and get this what they perceive as this notoriety, this personal benefit that they're going to obtain by going and murdering or harming other people. I think there's a lot to what you're asking about.
Younger males are, if you look at the data, younger males are the ones that are disproportionately involved in the dark psychological traits or suffer from those. Is there something that we could get into a whole show about culture and what we're doing to affect manhood in many different ways? Is some of this a result of this attack on the American male or in males in general?
Well, I mean, obviously, if you look at mass public shooters over the last 25 years or so, you're going to see like 97% of them are men. So they're obviously disproportionate there. With regard to the ages, I think it's much broader than most people might think. The highest rates of mass public shooters are 25 to 30, and basically then from like 35 to 40 or 40 to 45, and then you'll get like 16 to 20. But so the highest rates are actually kind of more older age individuals, but they are men. There's no doubt about that. They're people who are depressed, who kind of feel that the world's not appreciating them. They often are very intelligent individuals, they have gone down to this dark side and they are obsessed. One of the things is also about half of these mass public shooters were actually seeing mental health care experts prior to their attacks. One of the things that's interesting is that despite them seeing those, there's not one single case where any of these mental health care professionals that they were seeing identified any of these individuals as a danger to themselves or others. In fact, there's a whole academic literature out there that tries to explain for psychologists and psychiatrists why they fail to identify these individuals as a danger to themselves or others. And the big thing that they go is just how rare these cases are compared. You look at schizophrenia, you have like 2.5 million people who have schizophrenia at any point in time. And yet, over the last 25 years, you'll maybe find maybe two of the mass public shooters who had schizophrenia. And so they'll say, look, even if you could pick the 1,000 who would be most likely to do that, even if it's one of those, you're likely to be wrong 999 of the 1,000 times that are there. And so that's kind of their explanation. But the big thing is, it's the problem with the way psychology and psychiatry has been set up. They are set up for people with problems to come to them to ask for help. And so they assume that the people that they're talking to are being honest with them. And if you read the diaries and manifestos with these guys, it's kind of like, you know, I'm not that stupid, they say, to go and tell them I'm going to do something. You have something like the Buffalo mass murder. He had been in school. A teacher had asked him what he's going to do over the summer. He said he's going to find a school over the summer, shoot it up, kill lots of people, and commit suicide. Well, she was very concerned. She flagged him. He saw two mental health care professionals. He said, oh, it was a stupid joke. I shouldn't have said it. They basically took him at his word and let him go. The Santa Barbara mass murderer, similar type of story. He was seeing the head of psychiatric services at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, one of the leading experts of youth violence in the world. And he just said, look, I just have to tell the guy I'm not thinking about violent thoughts, and he believes me.
Wow. Yeah. Incredible. Folks, we've been speaking with nationally renowned crime economist and author John R. Lott Jr., president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. You're listening to America's Criminologist with Dr. Curry Myers. We'll continue after this commercial break. Dr. Lott will be back with us in the second half. Well, welcome back. We have Dr. John Lott with us, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Again, has some excellent books, more than 10 books. Hundreds and hundreds of articles of his books, More Guns, Less Crime, The Bias Against Guns, Gun Control Myths. Again, Milton Friedman once referred to Dr. Lott as he has few equals as perceptive analysis or analyst of controversial public policy issues. Want to talk about crime statistics before we get into defensive gun use versus offensive gun use. There are a lot of people that don't understand true crime statistics. I think we do a horrible job with crime statistics to begin with. It is always old and historic, number one, so we don't see it. A lot of agencies don't give out the full data skews that they should. Many times it's very historical and could be a year or two old. I think evidence-based policing would help with that. But there's key assumptions that are missing in crime statistics. The lack of police officers on the street could be a key
Right.
assumption. Victimology, where the reference to the national survey on on victimization. More and more people are saying, "I'm not calling police because it's not doing any good," and I've called
Right.
them numerous times before. We're also seeing the effects of decriminalization. When you have a whole world of decriminalization, that means law enforcement's no longer arresting people for those crimes that are taken off books. And so we have a lot of things to understand with, excuse me, not just drug, but crime data. Can you help dive into this and explain that we're missing some important data points in the retrieval of crime statistics?
Well, you've given a good 30,000 foot discussion on it. Look, there are two measures that we have of crime. There's crimes reported to the police, and that's the FBI crime data. And then we have total crimes. People don't understand that only about 40% or so of violent crimes are reported to police, only about 30% of property crimes are reported to police. In order to get a handle on what total crime is, a little bit over 50 years ago, the Department of Justice set up something called the National Crime Victimization Survey, where they survey about 240,000 people each year, and in order to get a measure of what total crime is. And generally, prior to 2020, those two sets of numbers, both reported crimes and total crimes, tended to go up and down together. Since 2020, they've pretty much gone in opposite directions. And you've raised some important reasons for that. One of the things that we know, we've known for a long time, that affects whether people report crimes to the police is whether they think the criminals are going to be caught and punished. If people don't think the criminals are going to be caught and punished, and that can change over time, that will affect the rate that people are going to report crime. So you look at 2022, for example. In large cities with over 1 million in population, only about 20% of reported violent crimes result in arrest. Only about 8% of total violent crimes result in arrest. Only about 1% of total property crimes result in arrest in those places. And so And so, you can understand why people might not think it makes a lot of sense for them to take the time to go and report them. But there's another thing that's happened too, and that is after COVID, we've had a loss in m number of police in many parts of the country. 6, 7 years ago, if you call up 911, they would go and send out a police car to go and take a police report. Now there's still parts of the country where you call up and they'll say, they'll ask you, is the criminal still there committing the crime? And people virtually always say, no, the criminal's already left. And they'll say, well, you can come down to the police station and you can wait in line and fill out a police report. And the bottom line is, if you make it more costly, more time consuming, more difficult for somebody to go and get a police report filled out, you're going to have some people who are going to say, look, it's just not worth my time to go and do that.
Yeah,
And
and I'll
so,
move. I'll move out of the city.
yeah, you do things like move out of the city, the stuff that we started talking about at the very beginning of the show, the fact that it has all these other effects on businesses and where people want to live and all sorts of things that are there. And I agree. So, the interesting thing is, if you look this last year, it looks like we have the lowest murder rate ever recorded. The final data is not going to come out until September, but the low they've really only have national murder data starting in 1900. And the lowest murder rate since 1900 before last year was 4.5 per 100,000. It was about slightly less than 5 per 100,000 in 2024, but it looks like this last year it could actually be below 4 per 100,000 for the first time. Now, with regard to crime generally, during the 4 years of the Biden administration, reported violent crime, according to the FBI, fell by about 8%. But total violent crime, rape, robbery, aggravated assaults, actually increased by 59%. It's the largest percentage increase that we've ever seen in total violent crime that was occurring. My guess is when we have the final numbers that come out in September for both reported and total crime, what we're going to see for total violent crime is a huge drop that occurred. And, to me, this isn't rocket science, as we were talking about earlier. I think you have lots of things that have changed. The FBI, for example, in 2025 had about twice as many arrests, more than twice as many arrests as they had in 2024. You have U.S. attorneys around the country who are actually prosecuting violent criminals now, as compared to what was happening under the Biden administration. You had Trump federalizing law enforcement in two areas, D.C. and Memphis, where we had among the highest murder rates in the United States, and doing it to a lesser extent in cities from Portland to Chicago. But the other thing that I don't think people are appreciating as much is the deportation of illegal aliens. I think. I don't think people realize, just the media will claim otherwise, the high rate of violent crime by illegal aliens. About 70% of the people who were deported last year had criminal records. Now, I know the media will go out and say, well, it's like 25% or 30%, but they're defining criminal records differently than I'd always known it to be defined before. It's not just whether somebody's been convicted of a violent crime, it's whether or not they've also been arrested. Because often what will happen is somebody will be arrested, they'll be taken in for arraignment, and ICE officials will be there to pick them up when they're being arraigned and go and deport them at that point in time. And so, but the other thing is also these numbers that you see in the press don't include whether they have a criminal record in their home country. Okay. If somebody's committed murder or rape or something like that in their home country, I mean, that seems something you'd want to maybe take into account in whether or not you wanted to go and deport the individual. But it's much more than that. It's much more than the individuals that you've deported. You have all these other criminals who don't want to be deported. Well, how do they keep from being deported? They have to keep off of police radar. And
Right.
how do they keep off of police radar? Well, they don't commit too many crimes right now, because the more crimes they commit, the more likely the police are going to catch them and go and then they'll be deported. And so it's not just the ones that you've deported, but also the fact that you're changing the behavior of the ones that you haven't even caught yet. I think all those things matter. Now, just to give you an idea of the crime rate by illegal aliens, in November last year, ICE came out with some numbers showing that in New York State, about 14% of the incarcerated population there had were illegal aliens. And that's pretty clearly an underestimate for multiple reasons. One reason is obviously New York was not helping ICE identify whether people in their jails and prisons were illegal. So undoubtedly, they even say themselves that they had missed some that were there. But on top of that, when you had illegals who were being arraigned, or when they were convicted, were often picked up by ICE before they even got into the prison system there and were deported at that time. So they're underrepresented in the prison system compared to their rate of committing crime. But if you compare that, even that 14%, which is again is a probably significant underestimate of their share of committing crimes, compared to the highest estimates of the percent of the illegal population of New York, which the highest estimates put it like 4%, which may itself be an underestimate, but that's still like 3.5 times, that 14% is still 3.5 times their share of the overall population that's there. So, you know, that's pretty much out there in terms of the rate of committing crime. So I think all those things matter, and, you know, the higher arrests, the prosecutions, and dealing with the illegal aliens and other things all matter.
Oh, no doubt. And you just hit on some excellent things that people really need to pay attention to your data, because it's so important to understand the entire picture. I would make also an argument on from the immigration standpoint that very true. That's one of the reasons it's having a positive impact on crime statistics in some era. But I sometimes refer to a blue state, red state phenomenon. Crime is going down in some red states because we're prosecuting and arresting people again,
right,
with the full force. In blue states, we're decrimming, we're don't have enough police, and it's going down because we're not paying attention to criminals. And
right.
You know, it's almost like two different reasons why crime may go down. And the illegal immigration, a lot of people may be committing crime that's really called underground crime, that they're doing it in that illegal community that's
right.
Never going to be reported.
Oh, yeah, no, that's an extremely important point.
Yeah.
And it gets back to something we were talking about earlier, and that people tend to commit crimes against people
yes.
who are similar to themselves.
Yeah.
And so, you know, blacks are disproportionately murdered by blacks, Hispanics are disproportionately murdered by Hispanics, but illegal aliens are disproportionately committing crime against other illegals
yes.
that are there.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so you have a situation where exactly what you're saying, those victims may be less likely to go and report the crimes that are being committed against. Yeah, this is one of the things that just puzzles me so much. People go and talk about the demographics of the criminals. You know, are blacks disproportionately in prison? Are Hispanics disproportionately in prison? And they care about that, and I can understand that. But the thing is, why aren't they equally concerned about the victims that are there? You know, why aren't they equally concerned about the fact that who are the victims of these criminals that are doing it?
Yeah.
You know, it's the same types of people in terms of racial groups that are the victims of the crimes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they say they care about illegals. Okay, well, that's great. I'm glad you care about illegals. But why won't you deport criminal illegal aliens? You know, people who are raping others or going and murdering other people. Who do they think they're committing the crimes disproportionately against? If they care about illegals generally, why not protect the illegals that aren't committing crimes compared to the illegals that are committing crimes?
Yeah, and again, in blue cities, you have homeless encampments that are still not
Right.
being addressed. They're being addressed in red areas, but no, there's no tracking of crimes
Oh,
against
yeah, no,
homeless people
there's no
at
measure
all.
of crime going on there.
Everything from rape to killing people,
Sure.
it's just death. They're just,
Oh,
oh,
yeah,
it must be an overdose. It must be an overdose.
yeah, no, well, I'm just look at the violence against animals and stuff that's occurring in
Yeah.
places like Los Angeles. It's heartbreaking to see how, the drug addicts are essentially injecting the drugs and stuff into the dogs to kind of test it out before they go and use it on themselves.
Yeah. Well, you hit on some major things, and this is why it was so important to have you on your show to really give clarity. Because, again, if you look at the data, violent offenders are the ones that reoffend. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 63%. It's,
Yeah.
if they get out of prison after 5 years, it's almost 70%. There was a prosecutor in California who's just retired that did his own analysis on people who were left, who made cash bail or cashless bail, just got out. The recidivism rate was over 75% for
Right.
violent offenders, for those that committed those. The other thing about murder, I think that needs to be brought up is that we are better with triage than we've ever been in the history of man in
Right.
preventing deaths. So our medical increases and our first response has been significant compared to, you can't compare murders to 20 years ago, because there are people that are being saved that would have made the list 20
Right.
years ago because of murder cases.
You're right. No, I mean you're exactly right about that.
The one thing I look at with manpower, and it's so true, is case closures. We have right now, especially in blue cities, pathetic case closures that are somewhere in the neighborhood of 30, 35%. It used to be that you'd get fired if you weren't hitting 70% case closures on violent offenders, and 80%. We have horrible case closure rates. You look at New York City, Doc, they're trying to go down to 27,000. They have almost 5,000 detective slots unfilled
Right.
in a department that used to be nearly 50,000 people. It's supposed to go to somewhere south of 30,000 in 2 years. It's incredible.
Yeah, no, look, there's so many points to bring up there. I can't remember the national closure rates for murder, but in Chicago, when Mayor Daley, the younger, was in office, got into office, about 67% of murders resulted in arrest. By the time he left, it was down to 30%. When Rahm Emanuel left office, it was down to 20%. And over the last decade, it's kind of bounced around in the teens many times that are there.
Yeah,
And when
horrible.
you're talking about, I mean, that's on average. And when you're talking about murders by gangs, which are particularly difficult to go and solve, you end up in a situation where people, even if they're witnesses for something, they don't want to come forward because they believe that there's a good chance that nothing's going to happen with those individuals that are there. And so, one thing, you mentioned kind of the blue and red differences there. It's very clear that the murder rates in blue areas are much, much higher than they are, in blue counties compared to Republican counties. The other thing just to point out is I don't think people appreciate how incredibly geographically concentrated murders are in the United States compared to the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah.
56% of the murders in the United States occur in 2% of the counties. 73% of the murders in the United States take place in 5% of the counties. So you have like over half the counties in the United States have zero murders in any given year. About 70% of the counties have either zero or one murder in the course of a year. And the thing is, even if you look at those 2% of the counties that make up 56% of the murders, about if you have a murder map of those counties, what you'll find is on average about two-thirds of their murders take place in 10 block areas within those counties. So it's very heavily concentrated in very tiny areas in the country here. So I think it's really a misnomer to talk about a US murder rate, okay? Just because there's such huge differences in murder rates. Basically, you're talking about gangs, gang related directly or indirectly type murders in those areas. people talk about the demographics of people who commit murders, but one of the things that's left out is that about 90% of murderers have a violent criminal record. These are not normal people in any sense of the word that's there. And, so anyway, but it's
Yeah,
just.
no, it's amazing. We got to switch because about this, you wrote again another seminal piece of work recently on defensive gun use versus criminal offensive gun use. Can you explain that research and the data behind it and
Sure.
kind of give us a summary of that before we close?
Yeah, sure. So if you look at the National Crime Victimization Survey data, it estimates that there's about 300,000 crimes that occur in the United States each year involving firearms. But there are estimates that there are like 1.6 million or so defensive gun uses that occur in that same year, 2021. And so you're talking about defensive gun uses being over five times occurring more frequently that year than you have crimes committed with guns. And this includes crimes not necessarily that the gun was fired, but somebody may have threatened somebody with a weapon that would be still classified as a firearms related crime that's there. And it just gives you kind of some perspective on this thing. It just kind of the rate that people use guns defensively to stop crime is so much more frequent than you see. Now, some of the stuff that happens, one of the big things that affects the firearms debate is that people constantly hear about bad things that happen with guns. They rarely hear about the benefits that happen. And a lot of that's understandable. If 95% or so of the time that people use guns defensively, simply brandishing a gun is sufficient to stop a criminal attack. Let's say you're an editor of a news bureau and you have two stories that come across your desk. One, there's a dead body on the ground. In another case, let's say a woman's brandished a gun, the would-be attackers run away, no shots are fired, no dead body on the ground. You're not even sure what crime would have been committed if the person hadn't been able to use a gun defensively. Which story are you going to run with in your newspaper? It's pretty clear. I think I would run with the dead body on the ground versus the other. Now, so it's understandable in terms of what makes something newsworthy. If it bleeds, it leads. But people need to understand that just because something's newsworthy doesn't mean it reflects reality in terms of giving people kind of a balanced perspective on the rate that guns are used defensively. So that explains a lot, but it doesn't explain everything. Our
Right.
website, since 2021, we've collected over 50 cases where police have said that if it wasn't for the presence of a concealed carry permit holder, there would have been a mass public shooting that occurred. And yet you look at those cases and they very rarely get anything other than local media coverage there. You've just over the last decade, I'll just give you a couple of examples. Everybody knows about Parkland. But do you know that just shortly after that, at another public school in Florida, there was an elementary school in Titusville, Florida. There was a get together of students and the teachers and the parents at a park right next to the school. Literally hundreds of students that were there. A man came up, started firing his gun. Fortunately, because it was in a park, not in a school, somebody there was able to go and have a permitted concealed handgun. He shot and wounded the attacker before anybody was killed. You look at the Pulse nightclub shooting that occurred in Florida, which at the time was the worst mass public shooting that had occurred in U.S. history. One week after that, there was a copycat attack at a nightclub in South Carolina. The person shot three people before a permit holder stopped him. Well, the difference between the two, the guy still had like 125 rounds of ammunition on him when he was stopped. That got like no national coverage. The difference is that Florida is one of 10 states that ban people having permanent concealed handguns in establishments that get more than 50% of their revenue from alcohol. South Carolina was one of the 40 states that allowed it. But anyway, it has a big impact on people's perceptions, what the media decides to cover or not, and how they cover it.
Doc, quickly, how can we follow your work?
Then go to our website at crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org.
Thank you so much for everything. Just you're a light of information, and I really appreciate everything that you've done in the field of criminology and the work. And I don't know where we'd be without you, quite frankly, Dr. Lott. So thanks to you personally for everything that you've done to make us safer in America today.
Well, thank you very much for your service. It's greatly appreciated.
You bet, folks. This is retired Sheriff Curry Myers. You've been watching America's Criminologist on KMET. Stay safe, stay informed, and remember to check out my work on Substack, drcurrymyers.substack.com. Stay safe and see you next week.